Successful Performer Cast, episode 66. This is the show that interviews one full-time professional entertainer per week with the goal of inspiring and equipping those who are working to make the leap themselves. This is the Successful Performer Cast. What's up, everybody? Thanks for listening to another episode of Successful Performer Cast. You probably hear my son there in the background, so just a little cameo for you guys. Anyway, we have a really, really good interview for you guys this week with Steve Spill, and he has a new book out. It just came out. It's called I Lie for Money, and it's basically about his life up to this point. And we get into that during the interview. He talks about bar magic, how he used to sell drinks, with his performing magic at the Jolly Jester. He also goes into his performance venue that he has right now called Magicopolis, and that's out in Santa Monica, California. He talks about, why he wanted to do that and how he put it together and made it happen for himself. So we're going to get into that in just a moment here. I also wanted to tell you guys about a book that I've been reading. It's been super inspiring to me, and it's actually one that one of my previous guests on the show had recommended. And the book is Be Our Guest, Perfecting the Art of Customer Service, and it's by the Disney Institute. And basically, it's all about how Disney creates magic. And I don't think there's any other company that does this any better than Disney, because, we go to Disneyland a lot, and me and my wife and my kids, and, they just seem to be able to, I don't know, maybe they're bottling the magic, but this book is all about how they're able to create this, what they call practical magic, and put it into their business. And they teach it in a way that we could also take that information and put it into our own businesses. So I wanted to just point that out to you guys. It's a really good book. I think you guys will really, really like it, and you'll be able to pick up some things that you can use in your business. You can find out more about that at successfulperformercast.com/beourguest. I also wanted to thank our sponsor for this show. This episode is brought to you by Josh London's Click Convert Profit and his book Flying Solo, The Smart Solopreneur's Guide to Making Money Online. Visit www.clickconvertprofit.com/performercast to get $10 off of the ebook. And for my listeners only, you also get the free ebook called 4 Ways to Find Your Most Profitable Keywords. Now, I'm going to go pick up my son. Enjoy the interview. It's my pleasure to welcome to the show Steve Spill. Steve Spill is a magician who's had a lifetime of magic and still has room for more. Having studied under magical legends like Dave Vernon, Charlie Miller, and Francis Carlyle, he's performed and produced shows around the world in places like the French Riviera's Cannes Film Festival, Universal Studios Hollywood, Harris Tahoe, and Massey Hall in Toronto. He's had his hand in a number of TV magic specials like World's Greatest Magicians on CBS and Penn & Teller's Sin City Spectacular on FX. He was the magic bartender at Aspen, Colorado's Jolly Jester, and along with fellow magician Bob Sheets, he starred in the longest-running show in Washington, D.C., called Magic Comedy Cabaret. In 1998, Steve opened up his very own magic venue called Magicopolis in Santa Monica, California, which is the home of Escape Reality, the show that stars him and his wife, actress Bozina Vrobel. Finally, Steve just released his brand new book, I Lie for Money, Candid Outrageous Stories from a Magician's Misadventures, and it's basically a memoir of his life so far. Steve Spill, I am absolutely thrilled to have you as a guest on the Successful Performer Cast. Thank you for being here today.
Good to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me. Let's get started.
Oh, yeah. So let's start off with a little bit of inspiration here. Do you have a specific mantra or a success quote that you like to live by?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's an exactly a quote, but what I can say is that nobody makes a living as a magician by accident. You got to want it pretty bad. And I think that success is enjoying the journey, and the stamina of a marathon runner is, you know, more important than talent.
Yeah.
I think hard work helps you improve. And when you're obsessed, you make your luck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So it's not any kind of a secret that magic is your passion, and so that is driven you to get where you are at this point.
I think that was a great bio that you cobbled together there.
Thank you.
Yeah, I do about 200 to 250 shows a year at Magicopolis in Santa Monica. It's a 150 seat theater. We're right off the promenade, it's, you know, everything from floating ladies, mind reading, sleight of hand. I'm a kind of a general practitioner, and I star in the show along with my wife, who's very funny. And we do a lot of different sketches. And, you know, the floating lady is a psychiatrist office scene where she's the patient, and I'm the psychiatrist. And that's the floating lady scene. My wife plays vampires and seance mediums and so on, and I pretty much play myself. It's a really great show. We have the ending is the Table of Terror, where there's 39 sharpened steel spikes 15 feet above me. The rope holding them up is on fire. I have seconds to escape before they crash on me. And so it's, like I say, we have from the tiniest kind of close-up sleight of hand to all the big tricks. We could, you know, it that's a really great show. I don't think, you know, I feel really it's one of the best magic shows anywhere.
Awesome. All right. So let's kind of go back to the beginning of things a little bit. Could you talk about, I guess, more of the beginning of how you transitioned into performing full time? How did that play out for you?
Well, you know, I can tell you that I always wanted to be a magician. And the very first time that I advertised my magic show, I was 10 years old. This was 1965. I was a paper boy. I grew up in the valley, and Tarzana was where I lived at the time. And every morning I would fold 74 newspapers. Then that's the Daily News was the green sheet then.
Okay.
And I used to have to put an advertisement in there. And I was putting an ad and a flyer into the folding into the paper one day. And it occurred to me that it would be great to have a flyer for a famous boy magician. So using carbon paper, this was before there was Xerox machines or, it was 50 years ago, no instant printing. But I made four smeary purple copies at a time of the flyer and put it in the newspaper. And I loaded the papers into the canvas bags on my Stingray bike and rode around town tossing the papers. And so I got a call, you know. And this woman says to me that, and this is my first kind of paid gig. And she says, you know, I'm having a beauty on a budget party. It's like a Tupperware party where I sell beauty supplies. And I think magic tricks would be great. How much do you charge? And, you know, I was stunned. I hadn't negotiated anything before. I said $3. And so I'm there at the gig, and there's like three giggly women and the hostess. And they seemed to be amused by my tricks. And I tried to leave, and the woman took me aside. She kind of whispered, you know, darling, wait till the party's over. I don't have the money, the cash to pay you until I sell my beauty products. So I'm waiting. And the women are having a ball, putting the different lipstick and mascara on each other and squirting each other with the perfume and so on. And then one of the girls says, oh, look at the time. Got to go. And suddenly the party's over. I'm alone with the woman. She thanks me, and she starts to clean up. And when I asked for my $3, she looked at me right in the eyes. She says, "Well, darling, the ladies didn't buy anything, so I don't have the cash to pay you." And she put her arm around my shoulder, and she starts escorting me to the door. And I have this really sad puppy dog look on my face. And I think, you know, my work should be paid for, don't you? And she says, "I'm amazed. But it's only $3. And she says, you know, there, look, honey, take this rouge and mascara if you want. And I'm thinking, what do I do with this? And she says, oh, sugar pie, you're in show business now. You need professional makeup. And what a ripoff, you know.
Just wow.
Plus the makeup gave me a rash.
But there you go.
So very early on, I had kind of an entrepreneurial sort of a bent and a passion to do magic. And I think throughout the book, that's one of the common threads. I mean, this book, I Lie for Money, is sort of a, it's aimed at crazy dreamers like us magicians that want to craft a self-directed, independent, creative life. And that's maybe the first sort of business kind of thing that is covered in there. But throughout the book, I have all the building blocks of, you know, I've been in magic 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
A lot of the work has been self-created. And it's, you know, some of the things worked out better than others. But today, I'm almost 20 years I've been doing the Magicopolis. And it's a great thing. I wish everyone could come and enjoy the show and see what it's like. I'm really proud of what we do. And I don't know how many people have been to the website or seen any of the clips or some of the work that we do, but I'm sure some of your listeners have visited. Got an open invitation. I hope everyone gets a chance to come.
Absolutely. And it's out there in Santa Monica, California. Now, one of the things that what I read in your book is that you did a lot of bar magic from early on, and I wanted to kind of pick your mind on that a little bit during our talk today. Now, bar magic is a completely different animal, and so I was hoping you could maybe first off talk a little bit about how it's different than, say, table hopping.
Well, you know, the bar that the jester, just to give you a little bit of a background, was a magic bar that was different than any other magic bar before or since. And the germination was that Bob Sheets had sold himself as a magic bartender to the Tower restaurant in Snowmass, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And this was a dinner wait sort of situation where the people are waiting for dinner in the bar and he entertained them. When we opened the Jester in Aspen, which is about 11 miles away, which is a very jumping sort of thing, we did about 10 minutes an hour of magic. And the bar held about 80 people, and it turned over about five times a night. So if you would walk in après ski time, like 4 or 5 till 2 in the morning, it was dark, there was loud rock and roll music, and we, you know... 10 minutes out of the hour, the lights would come up to last call brightness. Mm-hmm. The music would stop. We would do like some, you know, a great like 10 minute magic routine. And then as the audience was applauding, the lights would go down, the music would be blaring again. And we poured a lot of drinks and our most popular drink was the upside down margarita, where people laid their head back on the bar with their open mouth, and we would pour in all the ingredients of the margarita, the triple sec, and tequila, and roses, lime, and sweet and sour, and they would sit up and swallow. And for $5 extra, you could have your friend pie in the face. So when you sat up, there was like a cream pie in his face. Actually, it was a coffee filter with whipped cream.
Right.
This was a very wild, you know, and we also made all the funny drinks like Hiba Haba, the Chicago magician that Bob originally learned to tend bar from. You know, in the gin and tonic, you want a lime in that, and you pretend to take it out of the trash and dump it in there, and, you know, don't worry, the alcohol will kill anything, and so on. So it was a very wild sort of time. I started working there when I was 21. This is in 1976. And, it was not like any of the other magic bars that I've heard of before or since. It was just really wild, and we sold a ton of drinks. That was the main thing. We wouldn't start that 10 minutes of magic until all the drinks were half full. And for 40 minutes, we'd be saying, you know, we're going to have a 10-minute break where we won't serve any drinks, so get them now. Mm-hmm. Even the big, heavy drinkers were overserved, you know.
Okay.
And this was a walking, not driving, you know, it's a ski town. So they come off the mountain and the bar would turn over 4 or 5 times a night. So there would be a different 80 people 5 times a night. So any of the tricks that you were working on, you could do them 50, 60, 70 times a week. So mm-hmm. you could really polish something. And people that are getting wasted on alcohol are not shy about telling you when they see something, you know, or they catch you in the act of trying to, they see the secret to your trick or whatever. So yeah, it was good in a lot of ways. Yeah. A lot of what I learned about from comedy also was from the bar, from, you know, how to make it different every time, even though you're doing the same thing and brand new each time you do it. And sounds like the first time you said this and that. It was a really great working experience. And at some point down the road, Bob and I felt like we wanted to do a show together that got us out from behind the bar. And that's when we moved on to doing the Dinner Theater back east. It was actually the Brook Farm Inn of Magic was the name of the place. The show was called Magic Comedy Cabaret.
Okay, okay. So the one of the main reasons for magic behind a bar is to sell more drinks. So could you maybe talk about some specific strategies that somebody for example, I work a restaurant once a week out in Ventura, and it's kind of a brew house place. And so I'm also able to get behind the bar and entertain people as well. But I would like to sell more drinks, you know, to the people sitting at the bar. So is there any specific tips or anything?
A lot of the things that we would do is, you know, it's different when you get behind the bar and you're doing some magic or when you're the bartender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were actually the bartender.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So we were bartender magicians. So, you know, we would be pouring the drinks. We wouldn't start a trick till almost all the drinks are half full.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the trick was complete, all the drinks would be empty and everyone would need a new round. We wouldn't let people sit at the bar that weren't buying drinks.
Right.
You know, and this was a very busy bar. And if someone, for instance, ordered water, we would, you know, put the water and then put a bunch of whipped cream on top and a cherry and a long straw. So, you know, we wouldn't let anyone sit that wasn't going to be buying drinks.
Yeah.
And, you know, our motto, the more you drink, the better the tricks look. And, you know, mm-hmm. don't applaud, keep drinking. And, you know, this was long before, you know, this is many years ago before there was Mothers Against Drunk Driving or any of the, and it was also at a time when there was also a lot of drug use and, you know, Aspen was sort of a wild mecca. I mean, the year before we started, Hunter Thompson ran for sheriff and nearly won
mm-hmm.
on the guns and drugs, you know, platform. His poster had a gun belt on the top of a mirror with cocaine on it. He almost won the, you know, I mean, very narrowly defeated, like maybe 50 votes difference, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a time and a place that has long gone. And, you know, I don't recommend that anybody drink heavily or smoke or sure. do drugs or anything like that. But at that time, and, you know, I was 21, Bob was probably 25 or something like that. And it was 1975, 76, 77. It was a different era. And I don't think there ever will be we forced people to drink as much as they possibly could drink, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we did use the magic to do that. At the time, my dad was the manager of the Magic Castle, and which is a considerably larger place than our bar. And we would outpour the Magic Castle daily.
Mm.
I mean, you know, it was a money-making kind of bar, you know. But as for someone that's not the bartender, I don't really have a good suggestion. I, you know, this is a long time ago.
Right.
And we attended the bar and did magic. But as a bar magician, you know, I think that you can, you know, do one-on-one is mostly how the people do it. We were doing the bar magic for 80 or 90 people at a time. It was like doing stage magic. you know, okay. or stand-up magic. And I think most of the magic bartenders today, they're doing their close-up for, you know, 4 or 5 people at a time.
Right, right.
And we were doing it for 80, 90 people at a time and getting the same sort of reaction like you might get in a comedy club or something. And we were doing that 10 minutes out of the hour. And the rest of the hour, we were pouring drinks. So,
okay. All right. So how do you think maybe some of these tactics you were using back then would adapt to today then? I mean, I know you said people, magicians today behind the bar are performing for less people at a time.
Well, you know, this was a tourist bar.
Okay.
And, you know, we had a different 80 or 90 people 4 or 5 times a day. And it was a 10 square block area that had 108 liquor licenses. So people would be, you know, and people are on their vacation and they would stop in into the magic bar and then go to the country western bar and then to the rock club and so on. You know, I'm not sure that, you know, it's a different situation now.
Times are completely different. And
yeah. Yep. And our bar at Magiconopolis, we have a really terrific system because the people are collecting in the bar to wait to go to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you know, before and after the show and in the intermission, we sell a lot of drinks to people who are coming to the magic show. And so, you know, they have that opportunity to see Chad, who's a great magic bartender, do magic and pour drinks before the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of they're primed. They're coming here to Magicopolis to see a magic show. They're waiting before we're seating for the show. He does some genius tricks for them. And on the other side of the Magicopolis, we have the magic store. So those people who are under 21. We're demonstrating magic tricks that they can see or that they might end up buying before they go home. And then everyone goes into the show. So we have a little bit different system today. I'm not sure how many magic bars are out there right now, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and so it feels like a kind of an evolution sort of then in that the way you're using the bar at Magicopolis is to kind of whet people's appetite, obviously get them a drink, but, you know, get them ready to see the big show.
Exactly. And I'm not sure who's operating a magic bar today.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the one that we did at the Jester was not like any before or since. And you know, what we have at Magicopolis is certainly a lot of fun, and the people get a lot of personal attention, and they really enjoy the magic, you know, that's done right under their nose. And it's sort of like an appetizer before the main course, which is the show.
Okay. Okay, cool, cool. Now, during the time before the show starts, it's you and your wife who perform the main show. Are you guys ever out there in the bar beforehand so you can kind of see how the people are interacting with your magical bartender and trying to scope people out and stuff like that?
I am all over the place.
Yeah.
It's very often you will find me demonstrating tricks in the magic store, then popping behind the bar, then, you know, it's like the Wizard of Oz. I might pop in there and even sell a few tickets, and then the next second be doing some tricks behind the bar or in the magic store.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see me, all of a sudden I come out and I'm doing the show. So it's a little bit like the Wizard of Oz. You know, we just keep popping up everywhere.
Okay.
And it has a real unique feel because it is quite a production, but at the same time, it's sort of a mom and pop, a very personalized experience. You know, the people really feel like they know you. And of course, after the show, I sign books. And there's a lot of continuity there. I'm not in the dressing room with the fruit platter and the flowers and the
the green M&Ms, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's no writers in my contract. I'm punched in. I'm all over the place every second of the way. And I shake everyone's hand after the show. And I meet a lot of. Every show has a few magicians in the audience, and it's really a great experience. I think not just for me, but for it's like a two-way sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get to connect with so many people. And I think, you know, like for me personally, if I were to go there and you know, without any idea of who you are or Magicopolis or anything, to come in and get a drink and see you behind the bar, you know, demonstrating a little, you know, a trick behind the bar and personal interaction, and then going into the actual show and then seeing the person who I was pretty much hanging out with at the bar is doing the show. You know, I think that's huge. You know, it's really making a good personal connection with people too, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think also maybe more pertinent, or as pertinent to the idea of the successful performer cast, mm-hmm. is that besides being an artist, you know, we're also running a business. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's one thing to how those various identities sort of mesh. You know, to write and produce and perform a show in a theater that you designed, built, own, and operate, you got to be kind of equal parts dictator and diplomat. Yeah. You know, you got to be the great magician and storyteller and stuff on stage, but also the guy shoveling the raw sewage in the middle of the night because no one else would do it and everything would be lost if you didn't get it done. So you got to kind of be the extravagant artist and at the same time sort of the penny-pinching jerk, if you will. And it's not... You know, there is a lot of fun to it, but it isn't always easy. And it isn't about really money or fame, or it's kind of what it takes to share your vision with those that want to see it, you know?
Yeah.
And I kind of came to this conclusion. I didn't start working on Magicopolis till I was 40 years old. So I'd already been doing magic quite some time. And I was at a point where very often I would be home in my own bed like 5 or 6 days a month. Mm-hmm. And very often I would be gone for 6 months at a time, you know, in South Africa or in Europe or Asia or on tour somewhere, or being an opening act for a celebrity or in a review show. And I felt like Santa Monica would always be my home, but I wasn't at home often. And instead of constantly kind of changing cities to find new audiences, I needed to find a way to stay home more and have a new, you know, audiences constantly find me. The other kind of problem was that most of my audiences were not coming to see me in particular, and most, and not even a magician in general, usually. Mm-hmm. I was a corporate event entertainment or doing a comedy spot in a variety or review show or an opening act for somebody else. And even when I was a headliner, it was often at a comedy club where, you know, you went to see comedians and you might be surprised that the show's, you know, topped with by a magician. And so those were a lot of the factors that kind of drove me to do this. But at the same time, I had a lot of doubt. You know, what did I know about supervising construction and decoration or designing and building a theater or plumbing or electrical or organizing suppliers or equipment or staff or arranging publicity or advertising or, you know, lights and sound and all the million things that I didn't have any previous experience for. And so there was a lot of reasons not to do it. And it just, at some point I was just ignored that and just forged ahead. And I think, you know, whatever you want to do with your career, that sometimes it's, you know, better to forge ahead. And even if you make a bunch of mistakes, just go with it, you know, I think it's hard sometimes for, you know, jump off the cliff. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the point that I was at when I started working on Magicopolis.
Okay. I didn't realize it, but you literally built it from the ground up?
No, we had got the building and did a demolition, an interior demolition. But every wall, every seat, the theater, the bar, the dressing rooms, the offices, the magic store, the party room, everything was built.
Okay.
And I kind of took a little bit of a tip from Milt Larson, you know, who built the castle. I mm-hmm. used parts of other buildings that were being torn down and renovated. So the, you know, the seats I have are like, they're 100 years old. On the bottom of the seat, there's a little hat rack. They used to wear a lot of hats in those days. And I built the theater and designed it in a way that was perfect for viewing magic. I have a very steep rake to the audience.
Right.
There's like 1 foot high. I mean, 3 feet height between each row. The furthest seat from the stage is 18 feet. And, you know, you can see from any seat, the performer on stage from head to toe. And you can see from the back row, you know, what a card, what it is, or, you know, a coin or something. So it's built in a way that even though we have 150 to 180 people in the audience, you can do close-up magic. You can do stage, parlor, huge illusions. You know, I do a lot of big illusions as well as the close-up. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you know, so it was kind of built for that, to that. And so to make a long story short, I would like to see the people that are listening to this go with their passion. Mm-hmm. I don't know why there aren't more guys that are, you know, it's a throwback to Masculine and Devant or Robert Houdin that did their own theaters. And I think I took inspiration from those guys.
Okay. Now, after like all the building and the renovation and the construction stuff was all finished, how did you ultimately get it off the ground? What did you do to bring people in for the first shows and get the ball rolling on this dream of yours?
Well, you know, I called in a lot of favors and I started publicizing it. It took me a year to get approved to build on this spot and then 6 months to do the construction. So I had a groundbreaking ceremony and my friends Penn and Teller helped me with the groundbreaking ceremony. They put their hands, feet in cement. They broke through a brick wall and left their silhouettes kind of in the brick wall. And so I had a lot of, you know, TV coverage of the groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And then at the opening, I called in a lot of favors. Penn and Teller did the show. And I also had a lot of celebrities that were, you know, TV stars and stuff that came so that the opening was covered, you know, on all the local television and some national shows like Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and Extra and Hard Copy and all these different shows that were around at the time. And that really got the ball rolling for me, publicity, you know, as opposed to advertising.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So that got things, rolling from the get go, kind of thing. And I'd imagine after a little bit of time, things would kind of taper off a little bit. What did your marketing strategy look like after that to try and, you know, keep a consistent, steady amount of people coming in?
Well, you know, I'm going to sound really naive. I can tell you this. Aside from doing a Groupon once or twice a year, I haven't advertised for 15, 16 years.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, I'm in a very high foot traffic area.
Okay.
You know, downtown Santa Monica is on the ocean. I'm four blocks from the ocean, one block from the 3rd Street Promenade. I'm surrounded by thousands of tourists. Mm-hmm. And, in the old days, I used to put an ad in the LA Times. That ad would sell maybe 80 or 90 tickets per show. But as the internet sort of took over, you know, the print kind of diminished. The advertising, as far as TV and so on, is predicated on the population. So Los Angeles County has 10 million people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you really can't compete with that sort of advertising with Disneyland or, you know, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We just have to get a really good word of mouth going. We're in an area where there's a lot of foot traffic and we get a lot of repeat business. We have one guy that's come 48 times.
Yeah.
To the same show, more or less. I mean, nice. Come to see us. And, you know, but whenever he has an out of town guest or he has you know, someone's birthday or something like that, or he brings his company once in a while to the show. We also have a lot of different spokes in the wheel. Besides just selling the tickets, we do a lot of group sales. We do corporate events. We do fundraisers. We do a lot of birthday parties. The birthdays, of both kids and adults. The kids ones, the average class size is 30 kids, mm-hmm. and they'll bring 30 adults with them. There's 60 people right there. And, you know, we have generally at the matinee two parties. It's 120 people right off the bat. Huh. And we have a program where the kids have pizza and drinks, and then they have a magic class. And then they have the cake, and then they come to the show at the matinee at 2. One of the parties does all that stuff and comes to the show at 2. The other party is coming to the show at 2, and after they have the pizza, the magic class, and then with the cake. We do a lot of corporate events, the top salesman of the artificial heart or ad agency we had yesterday, you know, they could be in the afternoon or after work or in the evening. Mm-hmm. The shows that we have open to the public are Friday and Saturday at 8, Saturday and Sunday at 2. During the week, we do those other kind of private events. We also have the Magic Store, which is open 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. After the show, when there's 150 people coming out of the theater, that's when we sell a lot of magic tricks. And, you know, we don't, it's not like a professional magic shop. It's, we sell coloring books and scotch and soda and coin and bottle and, you know, the tricks that you'd find like at the Houdini's magic shop or something like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, stuff that's approachable for anybody pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bar is also another kind of adjunct to, you know, making ends meet. So, you know, we have a lot of little sort of cash cows in the mix there. And also maybe half a dozen times a year, we either make our magic consultants or have some commercial or a TV show that films at our place that mm-hmm. we participate in various ways. So those are kind of some of the things that make Magicopolis, you know, a viable concern all these years.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Before we continue, here's a quick word from our sponsor. Google AdWords, Facebook ads, Twitter, and what about Pinterest and SEO? Sound familiar? In the ebook, Flying Solo, Josh London shows you how to manage all the essentials for running a small business in today's online world. From search engine optimization strategies to pay-per-click tactics, your website and social media, you'll learn how to keep from pulling your hair out while increasing your profits. As successful PerformerCast listeners, you get to take $10 off of this book and get the free bonus ebook, 4 Ways to Find Your Most Profitable Keywords. Visit clickconvertprofit.com/PerformerCast to take advantage of this great offer. And now, back to our interview. Now, how much of all of that... you know, the little pieces of the machine that you have going on there, how much of that was initiated like from the get-go, or was a lot of it just kind of like, you know, you had the idea of this and you just kind of implement as you go? Does that make sense?
Yeah, a certain amount of it. I'll tell you one of the key things. From the first week we opened, people wanted to have their kids' birthday party. Mm. And I would say, you know, have the cake at home and come to the show. That was my attitude. And my wife put together this really great plan where they have they have the pizza. We have the magic class. During the magic class, they switch over the party room and set it up for the cake. Mm-hmm. And then they come to the show. And we have like a little party favor bag of tricks that they learn in the class. And she developed this turnkey plan that has become very popular over the years. You know, it's not – just to give you an idea, our tiniest – we have two packages that are basic packages. One is up to 15 kids and one's up to 30 kids. Mm-hmm. Our small no-frills up to 15-kid package starts at $500. And, you know, it goes up from there. And there are a lot of extra things that people order, extra food and magic tricks or popcorn for all the kids or what have you. And – in the olden days, when the economy wasn't, you know, what it is now, we would do as many as 40 parties like that a month.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And nowadays, we do fewer parties, but there are only very, very wealthy people that have the parties. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we do fewer parties because it's, you know, out of a lot of people's budget, mm-hmm. you know, today, but they're much more expensive parties.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, we same for the corporate events. Very often, a lot of the corporate events we do, we're running a show that you could have 180 people at for 20 executives or 15 people or 19 people. Almost all of the ones that we've done lately were very high priced corporate events, but for a very select few people. Also in the olden days when we had celebrities that would come all the time or bring their family or have a party, now they want to have it by themselves. And, you know, we'll have some very famous movie star or corporate executive or a sports star. And, you know, They'll have a party for 25 or 30 people, and they'll buy out the whole place. So, you know, what's the transition is that we used to do a lot of parties and corporate events, and fundraising is another kind of adjunct that is lucrative. But we do nowadays much fewer in volume, but all of those categories are much higher priced, and the people really want to pay for exclusivity. They want to buy out the whole place.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so could you talk about how you went about raising your prices for that? I mean, because
no, we didn't, you know, we actually have never really raised our prices.
Oh, okay.
And when we started in 1998, our 15th kid birthday party was $500, just like it is today.
Oh, okay.
The difference is now, instead of paying $500, some people want to pay $5,000. Because they don't want to have anybody at the show except their group.
Okay, so they're buying out the place.
Upgraded food. Instead of the party favorite bag of magic tricks, they want to spend $100 per kid. You know, these are very, very exclusive sort of things that are, you know, few and far between.
Yeah.
They make up for a lot of the normal price ones that we used to do. You know, it used to be that a $500 birthday party was, for the people that are listening to this that don't live in our area, mm-hmm. Santa Monica is sort of an upscale area. On one side of us is Malibu. The other side is Pacific Palisades, Brentwood. These are very upscale areas. And all of the kind of oceanfront cities are pricey to live in. And when we first started, there were not only more families. Now I think they're more single rich people, you know, mm-hmm. but for lack of a better word. But a $500 party for 15 kids was within everyone's reach. Mm-hmm. And even in these areas, we don't see the volume. We're not doing 40 parties a month. You're doing like maybe 15 or 16 parties a month of that type of party. But they're just more upscale.
Okay. Parties. And they're getting customized options.
Plus they're getting a two-hour magic show with floating ladies, mind reading, sleight mm-hmm. of hand, the dangerous Houdini escape, and we have a lot of illusions that are weaved into sketches. It's sort of culturally enriching, like a play. Mm-hmm. Besides the magic show, there's a lot of content in there, both autobiographical and observational and philosophical and so on. In our particular area, just a magic show, just the tricks wouldn't really cut it. These are people that are, a lot of the people in our area are in the arts. They are writers, producers, directors, movie stars, authors, screenwriters, you know. That's kind of the neighborhood of Malibu, the Palisades, Santa Monica, Brentwood. Those are our immediate area.
Okay.
And we have something, I think, to offer that we really don't have any competition. And even having a full evening magic show that you can go see, that's sort of a really refined kind of thing. I don't think outside of Las Vegas you really can find that. And when you go somewhere like the Magic Castle, it's terrific. But, you know, you can't really bring your whole family. Mm-hmm. If you're not a member or a guest, you won't be able to go. And you're also, they have a lot of fine performers, but they change every week. So one week you might have something that really appealed to you, and maybe the next week not. So we have like a, you know, we work really good at the Magic Castle because it's sort of completely different. And people that enjoy the Magic Castle also enjoy coming to Magicopolis. You know, we look at it like a Broadway show. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a completely different experience. I can't tell you how many people enjoy our show that also had a great time at the castle.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, Steve, let's shift the topic here a little bit. And so you have a brand new book out called I Lie for Money. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, I've tried to eliminate all of the boring things that have happened in my career and focused on the things that were either funny or interesting or that were inspiring to other people. Mm-hmm. And the book started like this. Several years ago, the Santa Monica Museum of Art had an exhibit, How Fine Artists See the Craft of Magic. Mm-hmm. And there were paintings and sculptures, and the centerpiece, Mark's son, Greg Wilson, was in this 360-degree film loop of him pulling a rabbit out of a hat and so on. And one of the days, I was hired to make a keynote speech about the journey of a magician. And so I did the speech, and a lot of people, and I spoke from notes. I really didn't have it completely written out. And a lot of the response, people seemed to think that it was a valuable to all artists, whether you're a painter, a sculptor, or because really you think about it, the same as being a magician. Mm-hmm. These are fields that are very difficult to make a living from your art. And so I was inspired at the reaction. And a few of those topics, I took my notes and wrote articles about that appeared in, among other places, the Vanish magazine, the digital magazine. I was talking to a friend of mine, Mark Miller, who's a comedy writer, a TV writer. And I said, oh, that reminds me of something I wrote. And I sent him a link to one of those articles. And when I talked to him the next time, he said, hey, did you ever think about writing a book? I just sold my third book to Skyhorse Publishing in New York. And, you know, I said, yeah, sure. So he sent some links to some of my articles, and they made me an offer to write this book. And it took me 9 months to write it. The last 6 weeks or so, you work with an editor so mm-hmm. that it's, you know, really refined. And it has a lot of really hilarious, funny stories, anecdotal sort of things that have happened along the way with me. And it also has a lot of inspiring sort of ways that people can take with their passion and make it into their occupation.
Mm. So it's practical as well as entertaining.
Yeah, I think that you hit the nail on the head. And I think that, you know, I would encourage anybody, particularly in magic, because if most of the people that are listening to this, I assume, are magicians, mm-hmm. To see kind of how it worked. I mean, like I say, I'm 60 years old. I've been doing this my whole life. And, you know, when I started out, in the 60s there, in the early 70s, like 70, 71, 72, there were a ton of places all over Los Angeles that you could, for free, work on your act. You know, all kind of non-paid on the job sort of training on Monday nights. You know, I'd go to the Hootenanny at Doug Weston's Troubadour, and on Tuesday I'd be at the Showbiz, owned by this guy, Murray, who eventually became the famous as the Unknown Comic. Murray Langston was his name. Mm-hmm. You know, Wednesdays, there was like the Palomino Club, this cowboy hangout that, you know, there were a lot of places to perform. And I think nowadays, most of the opportunities you need to sort of make them yours, carve them out yourself. And, in fact, that's kind of probably the big takeaway, from the book is that you can do it. It's just that you really have to depend on yourself to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Some hustle, a little bit of hard work, or a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think kind of, you know, if it's your passion, you know, the hard work or the stamina of the kind of marathon runner thing is if you enjoy what you're doing, it doesn't really seem like work. And I can't tell you how many people that have a lot of talent but don't have the work ethic that if they did, they would go a lot further. You know, you got to kind of enjoy the journey. And and I think the harder you work, the luckier you get. I mean, that's kind of it. You did not only helps you improve, but you sort of, you become obsessed. You make your luck, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of reminds me of a quote. And it's kind of been something that I've been trying to live by. And it's something that I heard originally, I think, in a book that Eugene Berger put out, but the quote is, "Sensible people get paid for playing. That is the art of life." And the quote is by Alan Watts.
Well, that sounds good. I go with that. That sounds like a good thing. You know, I think if you consider your work play, you have it beat. And that's mm-hmm. kind of one of the things about doing magic. If you really enjoy doing it, then it doesn't really seem like work.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. So, Steve, could you tell us one of your favorite stories from your book?
Wow, there are so many. You know, I'll tell you one that I have several chapters that are really fun for me. But yeah. One of the stories that a lot of people that grew up as youngsters doing magic probably would enjoy. There was a place called Joburg's Magic Store in Hollywood, and I was sort of a regular there. And so I'm 11 years old, and Joe, the owner of the store, I could never see how he stayed in business because he really cared for his customers, but he was constantly telling people that, you know, oh, I'm sorry, that trick's not for sale. That trick doesn't fit your personality. It's beyond your skill level. People want to buy stuff and he doesn't want to sell it to them. I'm 11 years old and I want to buy a lit cigarette dropper. Mm-hmm. This is a device that fits under your coat and feeds lit cigarettes into your pocket. And Joe tells me, if you want to work on something on stage, 11-year-old boys don't smoke cigarettes. Go with these feather flowers, the appearing bouquet will be good for stage. And I'm telling Joe, I say, I'm not a girl. I don't want the feather flowers. I want the lit cigarette dropper.
Yeah.
And Joe's not going to sell it to me. But I have a plan. Joe's son, Ronnie Berg, every once in a while, he minds the store because Joe has to take his wife to the doctor or something. And Ronnie Berg will sell anything to anyone at any time. Mm-hmm. So after about a million visits, I go into the store. Yes, Ronnie Berg's here. The lit cigarette, And Ronnie says to me, perfect for you, Steve. When young boy smokes, it makes him look more mature and sophisticated, like a man of the world. This lit cigarette dropper is in a class by itself. It's a handcrafted masterpiece created by an English artisan for Cardini. And Cardini, the highest paid superstar vaudeville. Now, 11 years old, I really didn't know who Cardini was, but I was very excited. And, you know, I'm thinking I touched this and he touched this and, you know, maybe I'll be the superstar. And so Ronnie says, you know, that the great Cardini was friends with my father, Joe. And on his deathbed, Cardini gave Joe this treasure. I wish we had another one so you could get a spare. This is the one and only one on the face of the earth. And, you know, when I buy it, I'm like trembling. It's like in the movies or something. Mm-hmm. About 25 years later, at a Magic Castle swap meet, I saw another lit cigarette dropper identical in every way to the one that I owned. Mm-hmm. And the guy says, there's a great story that goes with that. You know, let me guess, on his deathbed, Cardini gave Joe Berg this lit cigarette dropper. Anyway, we both cracked up. He had gotten the same Ronnie Berg story. I guess Cardini must have been awfully busy on his deathbed. But what's even funnier and kind of more significant to me is the fact that he gave me that story like in 1967 or something. Mm-hmm. And Cardini didn't even die until 1973. So it was also a lesson like on how to lie to someone's face.
Yeah, right.
Which is kind of a little bit of magic. The one time that I used the cigarette dropper, I was about 13 or 14. And I'd somehow gotten in with a group of guys who were a little older than I was, more sophisticated. And they knew a lot of teenage girls. And through them, I got invited to a party at the house, like the really popular girl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their girls are all several years older than me. And I'm secretly thinking or hoping that, you know, some cute girl's going to fall in love with me or make out with me or something, you know. So I have the lit cigarette dropper. And this was like a little thin metal box that had a little battery with a glow plug that kept the cigarettes burning so that when you made one appear, you could instantly puff on it and, you know, real smoke would come out and so on. So I had this under the vest, and I'm getting ready to, you know, I have a little misdirection. I'm getting ready to grab the lit cigarette. I kind of suck in my stomach. And when I suck in my stomach, as I'm going to grab the cigarette, like a space opens up at the top of my pants and the gimmick jiggles a little bit and I fumble and the red hot burning cherry of a lit cigarette falls down my pants and lodged itself in my underwear. You know, my balls are burning. I'm trying to wheel around and dance, and, you know, and smoke's coming out of my pants, and, you know, I'm embarrassed and everything. But the girls, they didn't know what I was doing. They all thought it was really funny. Like, I was just some crazy guy, you know. It was very fun. And but as it turns out, Joe was right, really. I probably was too young to play with lit cigarettes. Speaking of things going wrong, that mm-hmm. is in a different section. But I also have a section in the book of tricks that, you know, I worked on and developed. And for some reason or another, you know, when you sometimes build the props and write the script and everything, and you try it out, it just, you know, you got to make it work for strangers, for an audience. And if it doesn't, you throw it out, you know. Mm-hmm. So I also have a book of some of the things that I developed that I thought were really great, but for some reason or another didn't work out. I had this trick called the, well, for one thing, I said, did you ever pull on a straggling nose hair that you just couldn't seem to get out? I once
all the time, right?
yeah. I once developed and had a working prototype of like a tiny spool of thread gimmick that could securely be hidden inside a nostril. So you can see me at the comedy club pulling out the 10-foot nose hair, you know. I had this great routine called the bookworm that I thought would be a big one. That one was not a crowd pleaser. So, you know, I had a lot of them that didn't work out. One of them I called the bookworm, and I had an envelope with a prediction word in it that I would stick to the microphone. And then I took out a dictionary and had somebody look at it and see that all the words were different. And then I handed them a cardboard container like you get Chinese soup in. And they lift off the lid, and it's filled with earthworms, which, you know, night crawlers, what people use for bait. And they're live worms, you know. And the idea of the trick is I would flip through the pages of the book. They would drop in a worm. Boom, I'd slap the book shut. We open it up, and the squished worm is underlining a certain word. And, of course, we open up the envelope, and the predicted word is there on the, you know, on the paper. Well, you know, to me, it was a really great idea and everything. But half the time, the volunteers, they screamed, they dumped the worms on the floor, they threw them in the audience, or they refused to pick them up. It made it almost impossible to finish the bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was something that I worked out that I thought was really fun. And actually, probably the best one that I worked out that was kind of I had this trick called Timothy Leary's brain. And I had, I'm sure your readers all know what the Chinese rice bowls trick is, where you have the two bowls and you show them empty, and then you fill them with rice, and you put the mouths together of the bowls, and there's twice as much rice, and then you put the mouths together, and then there's water.
Yeah.
Well, I had this trick called, I had made a brain that looked like a human brain that you could split in half, and it worked like the Chinese rice bowls. And this routine was about people that have been lost to recreational drugs I had this big gnarly skull that I could take the top of the skull off, reach in, take out the brain, split it in two, and I'd show it empty. You can see this is Timothy Leary's real brain because there's nothing in it. At the time, he promoted the, you know, recreational drugs, and instead of the rice, I used to symbolize those we've lost to drugs, freshly dug graveyard dirt, which I put in there, and then, you know, it's doubled, and then at the end, instead of water, I'm pouring blood between the halves of the brain. I've tried this out a bunch of times. It just isn't, you know, what I want it to be. I'm ready to throw it in the garbage can, but kind of like gum stuck to my shoe. I couldn't get rid of it because someone wanted me to do it on a TV special. So I've done this, you know, and this guy comes up to me, and he says, man, that brain routine would be perfect for our Day of the Dead special, TV special. And I'm, well, what's the Day of the Dead? He says, well, it's a Mexican holiday where we reminisce about dead people and how they died. And do you speak Spanish? I say, I don't speak Spanish. He says, too bad. It pays $275. This is a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it's all I could get it phonetically written out and learn it in Spanish, you know, and it was great. This was for KMEX TV. It was like the local Spanish station. So I have everything translated and phonetically written on a big poster board. And I'm practicing it. And, you know, I don't really speak Spanish, but, you know, I can kind of do it with my cheat sheet there. Mm-hmm. So I'm at the studio, and this big poster cue card is leaned against the bar stool. So it's kind of below the height of the cameras. So it's out of the frame, you know. And the rehearsal goes pretty good. And in fact, you know, they say, it seems to go better in bad Spanish than it ever did in good English. And the director is telling me that, I have a great English accent with my Spanish, and, you know, they're joking around and they really like me. So now we're doing the real deal. And there's this blanket of foggy, dry ice smoke creeping across the stage. And apparently, you know, they wanted to help me with this, some special effect. And I guess, you know, the fog machine was expensive or something. They didn't use it in the rehearsal, but it's here now. And it's completely obscuring the Spanish words that I don't know, you know, that I can't do that. And the few words that I can see are dripping, you know, smears of marker ink. And, you know, I couldn't read a thing. My performance completely sucks. I just, no one has any idea, you know, what I'm doing. And the floor director is giving me the signal to talk slower. We can't understand what you're saying in Spanish, you know. And you know, the people that are watching, they don't know what I'm doing with a bunch of dirt and some brain, or they have no clue, you know. Mm-hmm. And then as I'm running out of time, he's giving me the signal to go faster, you know. So I struggled through it. I looked like the complete bonehead. And I want to do it over, but, you know, it was a live broadcast. This whole thing had just kind of poured into the camera lens and gone into people's homes. And that was the finish of my kind of appearance on Mexican television and the finish of Timothy Leary's brain. It did actually end up in the trash after that.
Wow.
But there's a lot of great triumphs in the book, but I wanted to highlight to some of your listeners that, you know, there was also a lot of failures along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're kind of, some of them are misadventures and some of them are really great things that really triumphs. I think, though, you really learn more from the failures than you do from the successes. So
I would tend to agree with that. And, you know, I really, really like the title, especially that word misadventures, you know, because I think it really kind of draws you into the book, you know. Now, where is the book available? Where can we find it, and how much is it?
Okay, it's available everywhere. Mm-hmm. At your local Barnes and Noble, at the Walmart, you know, wherever books are sold. Probably for most people listening, it's the easiest is just to go on Amazon mm-hmm. and put in "I Lie for Money" by Steve Spill, and but it's pretty much everywhere, and not only in the U.S., but also available in Canada and the U.K. Amazon seems to, you know, you don't have to even lift a finger, or you just touch a couple fingers on your keyboard, and it's on its way to you. And that's probably the most convenient for everybody. You know, there are fewer and fewer bookstores and places to buy books in person. It seems like they're going the way of the video store. So probably online is the easiest for most people. But if you happen to live near a bookstore, you can go in there and flip through it and look at it. Actually, come to think of it, I think if you go online, you can also, they let you flip through it.
Oh, interesting.
It's also on Audibles, so you can get the audio version. And of course, it's Kindle, all that stuff, you know.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna make it easy for my listeners to find it on Amazon. So if you go to successfulperformercast.com/I Lie for Money, you'll be able to find that there. Or if you go to I Lie for Money audio, that'll take you to a link for the Audible version of it as well. So I'll make it really easy for my listeners to find it online.
Great. Well, I hope some of them find that and it inspires them to, craft a life that they want.
Absolutely.
The best is to come to the show at Magicopolis. I sign books after every performance. And then you'll have not only a personalized souvenir, a bit of memorabilia from the the show, but you'll also have the book to read.
Perfect. Now, Steve, we're here at the end of the show, and this is just kind of a lightning round of sorts. I know. It goes by so quick, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was very quick, yeah.
Yeah. So this is basically where I have you give a couple of recommendations. And the first thing I'd like you to recommend is a resource that you always use to our listeners. And this could be anything from an iPhone app to something like a prop list. And then I'll have you recommend a couple of books after this.
You know, rather than an app or a prop list, what I can tell you is that I think it's important to script all of your work and do as many shows as you can. You know, I mean, even if they're for free, when you're starting out, you want to get a lot of experience. I think it's important to have a script. I think it's important to rehearse a lot. Be sure and wear the things that you're going to wear during the rehearsal and try and duplicate the circumstances you perform in. And whether you're a table hopper at a restaurant or doing the open mic at the comedy club or working toward being a trade show magician and gathering a crowd around a display, I think the script is really important. I can't emphasize that enough. You know, when you rehearse something till you're blue in the face and you can't rehearse it even one more second, when it's at that no-think stage that you can go out and do it and be yourself and the words just come out is where you can really embellish and improvise, and then you have that script to go back to when you get a little bit too far off track. So I would say script all your work. I think that's really important. As far as the books, you know, I recently been flipping through a great book called Getting There. It's a book of mentors. Mm-hmm. And it has all kinds of successful leaders in a really diverse field of from artists to business and everything. And I think the book is pretty recent. If I remember right, it's come out in the last couple of years, you know. So and it has, like I said, everyone from, you know, painters and movie stars to business people and so on, you know. And it's called Getting There, a Book of Mentors.
Okay, Getting There, a Book of Mentors. Could you also recommend a performance-specific book for us?
Well, you know, besides I Lie for Money, I I really enjoyed the Born Standing Up, Steve Martin book. Mm-hmm. About a comic's life. And I think that's definitely a worthy read for anybody that wants to be a performer.
Absolutely. That's one of my favorites as well. And by the way, the book Getting There, A Book of Mentors is by Jillian Zoe Siegel.
Oh, do you have the book or did you just Google that quickly?
I just Googled it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's definitely a nice thing. And it's all of the mentors are of a recent vintage. They're all living. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not like a from way back and you wonder, can they relate or something?
Yeah, yeah. But even still, I mean, the great mentors of the past, there is some great, great practical information to be gleaned from those that are still practical today as well. So
I think a good argument could be made that you could go back to Aristotle and Socrates and find some great advice too.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying that, you know, a lot of the younger folks that do you have any demographics on your listeners or not really? I just know that a lot of the younger folks, they can't even watch a black and white movie.
Yeah. I see what you're saying on that. So that certainly does make sense. Yep. All right. Well, I would like you to do one more thing, and that would be to give a piece of parting advice to our listeners and tell us where we can find you online, plug your services, any products that you might have. And real quick, just a quick note to our listeners, you'll be able to find links to all of the resources and all of that will be provided on the show notes for this episode, and you'll find that at successfulperformercast.com/Steve Spill, SPILL.
Yeah. Magicopolis.com is our website. You mentioned the Amazon link. Those are the two things. The book's available everywhere. We have shows every week at Magicopolis in Santa Monica. You can enjoy a day at the beach. There's also a lot of other fun things to do in Santa Monica. As far as the advice, I mean, the fact is I'm not big on giving advice, and I hate to give anyone false hope because, sure, you know, luck has played a part in whatever success I've had. But I will say this, by utilizing your skills and by being true to yourself and working hard, as I mentioned, it's possible to create an act or a show that will, if not rake in millions, at least not find you on welfare at the end of the day. And I think if you follow your heart and are kind of true to yourself and you work hard and some of the things that I said at the beginning, you know, if you want it bad, you'll love to do what it takes to get there and, you know, enjoy the journey and just look at it like a marathon run, you know. Mm-hmm. The longer that you work at it, the luckier you get. And working hard is just as important, if not more important, than whatever natural talent you might have. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're obsessed, you make your luck. I think those are the best things that I could share.
Perfect. Steve, you have shared all kinds of great information that our listeners can use to help grow their performance businesses. Thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing your experience.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. I really, really appreciate your time and your ears. So thank you guys so much for your support. Be sure to check out Steve Spill's brand new book, I Lie for Money. You can find that at successfulperformercast.com/I Lie for Money. And, also, please drop me a line. Let me know how I'm doing. You can email me at ks@successfulperformercast.com. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Shepherd or, look for me on Facebook. Basically, if you look for my name, you can pretty much find me. Hey, take care, guys. Have a good one. I'll see you guys next week, all right?
Well, darling, the ladies didn't buy anything, so I don't have the cash to pay you. What a ripoff.